The views expressed in this program are those of the participants.
Look, as an asset, you have to develop certain survival skills. Right? Chief of which is the ability to know something's wrong without knowing why. It's always something small. Static pop on your safe house phone. A slight delay in authorization using your credit cards. Or the almost imperceptible pauses in conversations with your handler. Something's wrong. And if you don't figure out what, you're not going to survive the week. Now, someone is trying to send this world spiraling towards war, and they want me to take the fall, but neither of those things are going to happen. Now, I need you to tell me what the name of the target is.
Look, let me call my CIA contact. She can help us.
No. Everything indicates that Pandora's being funded by military-industrial concerns linked with Eastern Europe. They can't pull off this operation, right? Not without help from the inside.
Welcome, everyone. It is Wednesday, December 3rd, 2025. I'm Bob Metz, and this is Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. Join us for an hour of discussion that's not right-wing. It's Just Right.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
It's an inside job. Tyranny, that is. And how are your survival skills faring in today's political zeitgeist? It's becoming obvious that fewer and fewer trust the government anymore. And with good reason. We are living in such a political dystopia that it's hard to properly put it into words. The entire field of politics itself has degenerated into an uncivilized shouting match, devoid of principles, devoid of morality, and devoid of any democratic restraints or processes. We have a very serious democratic dilemma, and it concerns the very misunderstood fundamental nature of politics and what has happened to political discourse in the West. No matter how much disdain or disinterest or even hatred of politics one may have, the fact is that no one can escape the direct effects of politics in their daily lives. Sad fact is, most people, if you go strictly by the numbers, aren't even aware that they're in grave political danger, for their well-being as well as for their lives. These are the NPCs, the non-player characters, to borrow a phrase from video gaming, around whom those aware of the danger must function and operate. Now, I'm hearing all kinds of concerns raised suggesting that it's the end of America, along with all kinds of solutions and cures to what ails America, and the rest of the world for that matter. And one strange undercurrent that seems to be found in the variant solutions is that many of them have given up on the traditional political process of voting for a candidate or party, operating on the belief that there are no political alternatives on the ballot, only a uniparty that calls all the shots, irrespective of the public's opinions. So I suppose we shouldn't be surprised to see many people asking themselves a question that we'll be hearing raised later on the show. So the question that begs asking is democracy just a fiction? And given that we're entering the Christmas season, let me answer it this way. Yes, Virginia, there is a democracy. It's just not what most people imagine it to be. As we shall discover right after our reminder that you can write us at feedback@justrightmedia.org. Hear us on WBCQ and on Channel 292 Shortwave. Follow and like us on your favorite podcast platform and visit us at justrightmedia.org, where you can access all of our social media links, archive broadcasts, and the support button that makes it easy for you to support the show. Because as always, your financial support is appreciated and is what makes this show possible. There are many uncomfortable yet simple truths about the nature of democracy in a free society that both its skeptics and its true believers simply never get around to facing. And I think that's too bad, because by not facing up to these truths and realities, too many people who should be getting involved in politics fail to do so, while too many people who should never be allowed near an electoral process are the ones currently controlling it. and arguments about whether a country's a democracy or a republic are next to irrelevant, because whatever laws and customs rule a nation, they are, as we recently demonstrated, merely conventional in nature, infused and assimilated into the culture of a people so governed. We made this point in addressing the status of Canada as a legitimate nation back on our November 5th broadcast, where our blog post contains the following passage, and I quote, "The uncomfortable reality underlying all of these issues is that nations are ultimately governed not by laws, rules, or regulations, but by convention. It doesn't matter what the laws of a given nation may prescribe if no one's obeying or enforcing them. Such laws are not worth the paper they're written on. In fact, such laws create a great disrespect for and distrust of government. When people do accept and obey certain laws which are enforced by government, then those laws are valid, and government becomes relatively trustworthy again. Aligning a nation's laws and written procedures with conventional practice is both a challenge and an objective that is part of a democratic debate. Every democratic nation is a permanent work in process, transcending many generations. There are no immutable laws or structures capable of preserving or protecting any traditions that would identify a quote-unquote finished or happily static society. Whether one is governed by laws or by convention is really secondary to the task of discovering the proper principles and practices that can foster a culture of individual freedom," end quote. And that's what we'll embark to do today. And of course, there is the whole matter of operating under a fake political spectrum, about which we'll also have much more to say nearer the conclusion of today's show. But before we address some of these rarely considered truths, let's first hear from some voices on the right who are growing deeply concerned and alarmed about the imminent collapse of what we have come to call Western civilization. So, coming up on this side of our upcoming bumper, Blaze TV's Glenn Beck presented an interesting theory on his November 22nd podcast, calling it the Bubba Effect. Though not exactly a term I would have picked, the general observation underlying his theory is an interesting one and makes a lot of valid points. But more importantly, Glenn is sounding the alarm about the actions of government officials publicly encouraging members of the U.S. military to not obey the orders of its commander-in-chief, Donald Trump. Unbelievable. And on the return side, remember climate change? Well, it's just one of the many hoaxes our governments and politicians have been pushing on us, and will continue to do so, even as the hoax has not only been completely uncovered, but its chief proponent, Bill Gates, has abandoned climate change as a threat. From his November 4th podcast, Peter St. Ong updates us on that change in climate on the other side of the bumper, but first, here's Glenn Beck.
The Bubba Effect is something that I brought to America about 2003, and it describes a really dangerous social dynamic that will emerge when the average everyday American citizen no longer believes in the institutions, government, media, law enforcement, our courts. And it begins with the local guy, Bubba. Bubba, it'll be Bubba against the officials, the government, or whoever. I've been warning since 2003 about the Bubba Effect that at some point it's going to happen, and it is everywhere today. This is rooted in not only American history, but in human behavior. So let me explain. When the government loses its legitimacy and people no longer believe the official explanations or the official investigations, and there is no official moral authority, the outsider becomes the trusted insider. Do you believe the explanations of what is happening on most things today? When a crisis hits, a shooting, a standoff, a raid, people stop siding with the government and instead side with Bubba, the neighbor who stands against the federal power. Even if Bubba is partially or completely wrong, the public's animosity towards authority is so deep that they go to defend Bubba, just as an act of protest. Once it starts, it begins to escalate everywhere. And then authorities have to crack down even harder, and that causes more escalation. Okay? Citizens resist more fiercely. Each side starts to interpret the other side as the aggressor. Post-Reconstruction, citizens preferred the local strongman over the federal enforcement of civil rights. Whenever trust collapses, citizens instinctively choose the closest authority in their community, even if it is flawed. You will defend even the wrong guy, not because he's right, but because the system is wrong. And that is the real danger of the Bubba effect. It's not a call to rebellion. It's a warning that unchecked corruption eventually produces rebellion spontaneously. It always happens. And the Bubba effect is a natural consequence of a nation that mocks accountability. Do you think accountability is being mocked? You're held accountable. Is anybody else? It punishes dissent, or no matter which side you want, you're on. You're either a communist or a Nazi, and you need to be shut up. It hides behind bureaucracy. Well, we can't release that because we don't have all the details because, well, this is an ongoing investigation, an investigation that nobody believes. And then it expects unquestioning obedience. Trust us. There's nothing to see here. The Bubba effect is a symptom of a republic in decline, not the cause of it. Now, let me show you a different kind of Bubba effect. Here are the Democrats putting together something that is aimed directly towards the Bubbas in the military and the CIA. Listen.
I'm Senator Alyssa Slotkin.
Senator Mark Kelly.
Representative Chris DeLuzio.
Congresswoman Maggie Goodlander.
Representative Chrissy Houlihan.
Congressman Jason Crow.
I was a captain in the United States Navy.
Former CIA officer.
Former Navy.
Former paratrooper and Army Ranger.
Former intelligence officer.
Former Air Force.
We want to speak directly to members of the military
and the intelligence community
who take risks each day
to keep Americans safe.
We know you are under enormous stress and pressure right now.
Americans trust their military.
But that trust is at risk.
This administration is pitting our uniformed military
and intelligence community professionals
against American citizens.
Like us, you all swore an oath
to protect and defend this Constitution.
Right now, the threats to our Constitution aren't just coming from abroad,
but from right here at home.
Our laws are clear. You can refuse illegal orders.
You can refuse illegal orders.
You must refuse illegal orders.
No one has to carry out orders that violate the law
or our Constitution.
We know this is hard
and that it's a difficult time to be a public servant.
But whether you're serving in the CIA,
the Army,
or Navy,
the Air Force,
your vigilance is critical.
And know that we have your back.
Because now, more than ever,
the American people need you.
We need you to stand up for our laws,
our Constitution,
and who we are as Americans. Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up.
Don't give up the ship.
All right. All right. This is not about Republicans. It's not about Democrats. It's not about the president, Donald Trump. This is something that no generation of American has ever seen, not in 250 years of constitutional history. A group of sitting members of Congress, senators and representatives, went on camera and told active duty military personnel and the CIA to ignore orders of the President of the United States. They didn't whisper it. They didn't couch it in a private memo. They released it in a video for the entire world to see. What message is that sending to the rest of the world? For the first time in American political history, members of the United States Congress openly encouraged the military to look at the commander-in-chief and say, no. Now, this does not happen in a constitutional republic, and it cannot happen in a nation that wants to remain one, because every generation up until this one understood something very basic. You cannot politicize the chain of command without breaking the republic. And once the military begins to decide on its own which orders are legitimate, which ones you know, which president they prefer, you no longer have civilian control. You no longer have a republic. You have factions inside an armed institution. And that is exactly how nations collapse. And every single one of those sitting representatives know it. And this is the part where you need to hear me clearly. What we saw here this week with this is not the Bubba effect, where ordinary citizens lose trust in authority or rally behind the local guy. No, no, no. This is something far more seditious and serious. This is the institutional Bubba effect, where leaders inside the government with their own plan, the political class, begin urging Bubba in the military to take sides in domestic political disputes. That is a very, very bright line. The great unbroken line in American history. Unbroken in our history. That line kept us from becoming every other failed republic. And now, these people have stepped over it. Even if these lawmakers thought they were just, you know, recommending moral guidance, they believe they were just reminding the troops to refuse illegal orders. That's not your job. That's the job of the generals and the job of Pete Hegseth. They do that in every classroom. Every time they're sworn in, they are told those words. That comes from within the ranks, not from political leadership. The military does not take sides. Period.
The global warming hoax is collapsing as one of its biggest champions admits it's actually not a big deal. Maybe we won't eat the bugs. The admission comes from warming poobah Bill Gates, who after decades trying to make cows stop farting is now calling for a, quote, strategic pivot away from, quote, doomsday views, since actually other stuff like poverty matters more. Trump gloated, quote, we just won on the climate change hoax. Cynics noted Bill Gates' incredible timing now that Microsoft needs gigawatts of power for AI data centers. Now, it's been 50 years since the global cooling Armageddon transformed overnight into first global warming, then when the data did not pan out, climate change to cover all the bases. Since 1993 alone, roughly $200 billion has gone to paying academic whores, or prestigious professors, to publish papers hyping an imaginary global catastrophe. Now, $200 billion is a lot of money in academia where you can buy a professor for a couple thousand dollars. The money was enough to make them destroy any dissenting professor for questioning the, quote, consensus. Say, for pointing out that official temperature sensors are built in asphalt parking lots or next to air conditioning units. Now, any academic field that's cashing $200 billion checks while firing anybody who disagrees is not a science, it is propaganda. Propaganda running on mafia rules of plata o plomo, take the silver or get the lead. Now, academia was worth buying because it was the designated useful idiot to unlock $2 to $3 trillion in taxpayer money for green energy projects, including the infamous Solyndra that torched a $500 million of taxpayer money, Abound Solar and Calisolar, another $300 to $400 million each, the Ivan Pa complex in California that lost $2.2 billion of taxpayer money and produced so little energy it literally ran on natural gas and then resold it at 6 times market, which Californians were forced to buy. Wind is even worse, with 4 projects alone, Skipjack, Orsted, Empire, and Revolution, losing $8.5 billion taxpayer dollars so far. Note, the owners all make out like bandits. Taxpayers and electric customers pay the bills. A lot more is coming, with Biden alone handing out $800 billion for crony green projects. Note, all these losses are separate from the thousands of climate regulations and mandates. Manhattan Institute estimates climate rules add $6,000 to the cost of a car. The National Association of Manufacturers estimates climate mandates cost $17,200 per employee per year, which is a major reason companies move to China. Meanwhile, the climate itself loves carbon dioxide. It's what plants eat. In fact, actual greenhouses pump in CO2 to make the plants grow. A 2020 satellite study found Europe's forests are expanding at 1 million acres per year thanks to higher CO2, and if temperatures do eventually rise, barren tundra could feed millions. So as Sex brought to you by iTrust Capital, even with Bill Gates admitting the hoax, the climate industrial complex is far from dead, there is too much money at stake. Just last year, the UN called for $150 trillion for climate, which is just shy of a bazillion. Europe and Democrats and professors remain wed to a hoax that pays for their vacation homes, so we may not have won yet, but the tide is turning. Okay, we'll be watching.
So, even though the climate has changed on climate change, political interests never change. A lesson in and of itself. From COVID to climate change to sexual and identity politics, the outright frauds and criminal corruption going on in plain sight have raised a myriad of issues and questions that need to be addressed. In fact, believe it or not, I recorded that climate change update by Peter St. Ong on YouTube, which, right under his podcast entitled Climate Change Hoax Collapses, posted the following notice. Quote, "Climate change, United Nations. Climate change refers to long-term shifts in temperatures and weather patterns. Human activities have been the main driver of climate change, primarily due to the burning of fossil fuels like coal, oil, and gas," end quote. And of course, this is a 100% falsehood, a total lie from a group calling itself the United Nations. And when Glenn Beck says that people will support Bubba even when Bubba is wrong, what he was effectively describing is the political practice of voting for the lesser of two evils, something we'll take a closer look at right after hearing, on this side of our upcoming bumper, Brett Weinstein elaborate on what it means to govern ourselves, as heard on the November 18 podcast of Dad Saves America. And on the return side, on his November 22nd edition of Sargon of Akkad, Carl Benjamin reveals a hidden motive behind James Lindsay's concept of a woke right. And then let the fun begin.
Our civilization, to the extent that it is a departure from history, is based on the consent of the governed, which means that we govern ourselves. But if something has gotten leverage over important people sufficient to cause things that we want not to happen and to cause things we don't want to happen, then we are not self-governed. So I don't see higher priorities than understanding to what extent the democratic nature of our society is a fiction.
It sounds like what you're saying is that we are in a kind of emperor has no clothes moment. I don't mean about Trump. I mean about our institutions. I mean about the nature of at the Western civilization, America, what governs the world, what works, what's really going on. And there's a couple things and ideas that have scrambled this for me, certainly. One of which is the internet and its sort of radical information tsunami has stripped the elite in our society of their clothes. So the emperor literally has no clothes and we get to see it. And so this has produced this profound level of distrust in the institutions and the people and the leadership. And it is distrust that is warranted because they're not trustworthy and we get to see it. And so there's two ways I think about that. One is they've always been this corrupt. And what's new is we're getting to see it, and that's a sociological, social evolutionary thing that we're getting hit by, kind of like when the printing press came out. And this is just one more example of that. JFK was basically coercing underage girls to have sex with people in the pool at the White House. This is not new, being gross. But I think you're saying something different than that, which is that there's a change that's going on. Or are you? Are you saying maybe it's not a change? Maybe we're just having the scales fall from our eyes, and this is just a really acute way for it to happen.
I can say with high confidence that our institutions are beyond catastrophically dysfunctional. There is a question about how far back that goes.
Yeah.
I can say I think it's gotten profoundly worse over my lifetime. I think I'm old enough. I'm 56, and I think I'm old enough to barely remember functional governance. And I think that most of my life, certainly all of my adult life, has been lived under what I would call entirely malignant governance, which gives people the impression that actually you'd be better off without government because it's effectively, you know, a big spreading tumor. And yeah, you'd be better off without the tumor, but you wouldn't be better off without the thing that the governance built initially. The institutions are effectively Potemkin at this point. That you can be certain of.
And just for clarity, what do you mean when you say institutions?
Pick an example. Universities.
Yeah.
Okay. We have universities, and they, if you walk onto a campus, it sure looks like that they're doing a pretty decent job of educating young people so they go into the world with, you know, enhanced cognitive capabilities, and that they're, you know, hard at work studying nature and discovering what makes us healthier and all that. If you look at the product and you test it, you know, do they actually make people smarter? No, there's a pretty credible argument they make people dumber on average, because what you've got at the very least is a competitive environment in which cheaters actually rise faster academically than people who play the game honestly. And so what you have is a system that becomes a test of how well you can cheat. Let me ask you this. Downstream of a university system that is demonstrably phony, why do we expect the institutions that are inhabited by people who were trained in those universities to be any better? And they aren't.
In a very particular way that seems really strange under this kind of basic scrutiny. Do you have a theory, or do you have a model of the elite?
Let's just leave open the possibility that the elites is a real thing, but that our guess as to who's in and who's out is liable to be rough at best. I think you can say the following thing. The idea of a free civilization in which people are liberated to do a great variety of things, and where you, in general, are rewarded for figuring out how to create wealth. And the more wealth you create, from which we all benefit, the better you do. I'm not saying that that's the system will never work perfectly that way, but a system that roughly worked that way is more or less what we think we have or are supposed to have.
It's better than plunder. It's better than piracy.
Oh, I think it's marvelous. I am an unashamed defender of the idea of the West, which is not a list of countries. It's a belief that we should level the playing field, liberate people as meaningfully as we can. Everybody should play their cards as effectively as they can, and we should expect and, in fact, desire people to be differentially rewarded based on how successful they are at creating wealth from which we all benefit. I think you're not going to beat that system. However, once you've attained another level, right, a level above what almost anybody ever achieves, you have a lot to lose. Mm-hmm. And the idea that you might therefore view with some concern all of the various contenders to join and ultimately displace. In other words, there should be some churn amongst the people at the very top based on the fact that the people at the very top may play their cards badly and disappear from that strata, and other people will play their cards well and they will join. And so if you're in that strata, the question might be, well, what can I do to make sure that I'm always here? Right? And you might imagine that collusion would emerge between them. So what I'm effectively arguing is that we little people should, if we're wise, should want the system that matches the brochure of our civilization. And then we've got a bunch of people who will naturally wish to conspire against that, because built into that description that I've just given is a threat to their position.
I know there's been some interesting writing on a potentially powerful force in human history has been fighting amongst elites, essentially to protect turf. Is that how you understand it? Is that another way to look at it?
Yeah, it makes perfect sense. The way the game evolves in the case of our democratic republic, we are effectively prevented from having reasonable choices so early in the process that we are forced to choose between unreasonable choices, all of which are effectively acceptable to the elites that haunt our system. And we would be wise to break out of that dynamic. My sense is we little people suffer from a informational disadvantage that is now being fully cultivated by some force whose name we don't know.
I thought we'd have a quick chat about the schism on the right, because this whole thing, I think, probably was inevitable, and only actually resolves in one way. So you've got people like James Lindsay and the rest of the sort of centre-right types. Joel Berry was on Tim Pool's podcast, and they're deeply concerned about something they call the woke right. And I spoke to James about this at the last art conference, and he told me that he deliberately used this term frivolously in order to sow discord on the right. But the problem is, these people basically aren't woke. It's not that they are woke. What it is that they are self-interested, and they are reacting against a series of power structures that they perceive, and it is in this that James is identifying the wokeness. The problem with the woke left isn't really the woke part, it's the left part. That statement is true. That is completely correct, and I stand by it, because actually the problem isn't the woke part, it is the left part, because the left part is what informs the woke part. By saying, no, it's not the left that is the problem, it is the woke that is the problem, what they are saying is, leftism is a core part of their own philosophy, which is why they are leaping to its defense.
You are listening to Just Right, broadcasting around the world and online. And that was a very astute observation by Sargon of Akkad's Carl Benjamin. And to learn that James Lindsay told him that he deliberately created the term woke right in order to sow discord on the right just adds a final touch to our own June 18 broadcast entitled Woke Joke, the Fallacy of the Woke Right. And the first paragraph of our blog post of that day read, quote, "By inventing the term woke right, author, mathematician, and cultural critic James Lindsay has created a nonsensical anti-concept that has done more damage to causes on the right than any fake news media could. Fake concepts are far more dangerous than fake news narratives," end quote. Now to address the comments of Brett Weinstein, who earlier said, "Our civilization, to the extent that it is a departure from history, is based on the consent of the governed, which means that we govern ourselves." Well, I fully agree with that ideal, but unfortunately, it's easier said than done. It occurs to me that in order to have a society based on the consent of the governed, one must first have a society of people who themselves live on a principle of consent. I mean, how can people consent to an existing government if they do not already have the right to consent? In fact, maintaining an environment of consent is the primary function of any government of a free society. And we have to be careful not to confuse the electoral process as being the means of how the consent of the governed is determined. Elections are about consensus, not about consent. In order to have a consensus on something, those participating in that consensus must already have consented to abiding by the results of the consensus in advance. Does this make any consensus to you? Do you see the problem and the danger? When one or more sides in a consensus advocates the use of force instead of consent, then we've arrived at the fundamental contradiction that makes democracy, as most people understand it, a myth or a fiction. I mean, how can one consent to giving up one's right to consent? Because that's exactly what happens every time the right allows the left to win a consensus. Ayn Rand objected to the term democracy outright. Quote, democratic in its original meaning refers to unlimited majority rule, a social system in which one's work, one's property, one's mind, and one's life are at the mercy of any gang that may muster the vote of a majority at any moment for any purpose. End quote. And one of the problems keeping this contradiction hidden from view is the basic language and words we use when we talk about quote-unquote democracy. Majority rule is different from majority governance. I've talked about this before. In a free democracy, no one rules anyone. But a free society does have rules that apply equally to everyone, predicated on the principle that no one may initiate the use of physical force against another. Now, why a democracy is presumed to be a system of unlimited majority is a question I've never really seen addressed. Why wasn't it considered to be a system of limited majority rule? But even so, by what principle, moral or otherwise, can one justify the forcible rule of some by others simply on the basis of a given number in a consensus? It's ridiculous. I mean, so you've got 10 people sitting in a room, and suddenly 6 of them decide to rob the other 4. That's okay? Just because 6 is more than 4? I mean, this is kindergarten arithmetic being used to justify something immoral and unjust. Moreover, majority governance differs from majority rule in 2 key aspects. Governance is a process that applies to all equally, while rule is a process exercised by some over others. And majority, in the case of governance, is not about a numbers game. It identifies the status of those qualified to vote, those who have reached the age of majority, thereby having assumed all of the freedoms and responsibilities that accrue to that status. And not coincidentally, this is often referred to as the age of consent. Go figure. Weinstein also cited a profound level of distrust in the institutions and gave as an example the universities. And he said, I can say with high confidence that our institutions are beyond catastrophically dysfunctional. Well, it's been my experience and observation that institutional corruption is caused by state funding directly to institutions instead of through the individuals requiring financial assistance with regard to a service. As for example, in the idea of offering parents the right to direct their education taxes to the school of their choice. Democracy, like government, must be limited in terms of elections and voting. There should never be any votes allowed that would violate or infringe on the individual rights of others. When viewing democracy simply as a political system of majority rule in terms of a majority of numbers rather than as a matter of identity, then the nation is in extreme danger, since this makes taking over a country from the inside a very viable objective. But, says Brett Weinstein, we are effectively prevented from having reasonable choices so early in the process that we are forced to choose between unreasonable choices, all of which are effectively acceptable to the elites who haunt our system.
Ladies and gentlemen, I am here to inform you that the rumors are indeed true. The Democrats have struck back. In the New Jersey governor's race, the Democrat won. In the Virginia governor's race, the Democrat won.
Yep.
And in the New York City race, Democratic Socialist Zoran Mamdani defeated Andrew Cuomo to become the next mayor of America's largest city. But the question on everyone's mind is,
that's right,
was it just a fluke? Just easy wins in blue cities and states? Or is there something more to this?
Both, I think.
Is this a sign of things to come? Is the Democratic Party finally turning their losing streak around? Are they actually listening to the people now? Did they finally learn their lesson?
No, absolutely not. I think that what happens is that people vote for the other political party to change things from the way that they are, and then they get worse. And then people vote for the other political party to change things from the way that they are, and then they get worse. And then people vote for the other political party to change things from the way they are, and then things get worse.
Yep, And let me say, from personal experience, both on the provincial and federal level in Canada, even when there is a third or fourth alternative created that reflects what voters say they support, they'll still vote against instead of for. Now, on this side of our upcoming bumper, Dinesh D'Souza shares a letter written by a father of an 11-year-old boy attending an elementary school in his area, who, upon attending his son's school, describes an environment so dystopian and evil that the only thing I can say at this point is if your child or your children are in a similar quote-unquote educational environment, get them out of there as fast as you possibly can. It's a horror story. And on the return side of the bumper, none other than Nick Fuentes offering his political recipe for a winning political party platform. What a train wreck. But first, here's D'Souza.
Let's listen to this parent. My 11-year-old son joined the elementary school band. So the parent goes to the band and sees the classrooms are inundated with DEI messages and trans pride flags. On the walls were posters, stickers, various decorations invoking various totems of diversity. Black Lives Matter, decolonization, LGBTQ, every sort of race and gender social justice messaging you can imagine. Then you have these themes of social justice hammered into these young people, indigenous ways of knowing, safe spaces for all kinds of ethnic and minority groups. And then a woman in a mask who was evidently in charge got up and read a number of land acknowledgments before acknowledging the contribution of indigenous people to indigenous ways of knowing. So there's a little bit more of this. And then when it comes to how the teachers behaved, I'm going to draw on that night and the other times I've been at my son's school. To begin, the boys are treated almost as though they are defective girls. Wow. The feminine modes of interaction and socialization are treated as though they are the only legitimate modes of interaction. Almost all the authority figures in my son's school are women, with almost no exceptions. And one day the school hired a single male education assistant, and the boy comes home and says he's amazed to see a male teacher in the school. So my son comes home from school, expresses utter frustration that his own way of communicating is automatically treated as weird, maybe autistic, defective, handicapped in some way, and that he lacks all the qualities, basically female qualities, that essentially make him out to be a deficient person. And now I want you to imagine what it's like for an 11-year-old boy to be saturated in this environment day after day. He is an alien in his own school. He's treated like a ticking time bomb. So the hostility toward the boys that is driven in at every level of the institution produces at some point a pushback and a revolt. And by and large, what this parent is saying, what I want to point out to you, how absurd the world must appear through the eyes of the average 11-year-old boy. He's told he has a host of advantages, white privilege, male privilege, straight privilege, that he has never experienced. And he will never benefit from. And this justifies the system that he is immersed in. And the worst part is if he tries to point this out, the very people who are doing it will look at him straight in the face and say, we're not doing it. This has never happened. And all of this is happening in your most formative years. So according to the parent, look, this is going to produce a pushback that is very, very strong. Once you understand all this, says the parent, the real question is not, why are some young men radicalizing? The real question is, why are there any young men at all who have not been radicalized? Now, the parent goes on to say, none of this is to excuse any of the extremist radicals. The point here is to understand where this is coming from. But I also want to take this post, a very eloquent post, by the way, very heartfelt post, and in my view, accurate post, to show what it is that these young people are really against. Because to listen to them, they are against a whole bunch of different things. They're against the post-war economic order going back to 1945. If they believe a guy like Tucker, they're against the whole story of World War II. They're against the Greatest Generation. Some of them are against, like, Vivek Ramaswamy. They're angry at immigrants. But you notice that all of this that I've just described is nothing more than heavy-handed, browbeating leftist ideology. This is the leftist ideology that has overtaken their schools and their colleges. This is what these young people are enduring day after day. It's the full triumph of leftism. So I guess what my take on all this is that we have seen leftism run rampant in our culture. Now, again, is this the fault of the conservatives? Because there's a lot of anger among the younger generation toward their own parents, even if their parents are conservative. And the idea is, why didn't you stop this? And it's actually worth answering that question, because the truth of it is, the reason we didn't stop it is because we couldn't. The reason we didn't stop it is because we were outnumbered 8-1. The reason we didn't stop it is because we didn't have anything like the resources of the people who are implementing these programs over our objection.
If you had progressive Democrats and nationalist Republicans working together, let's say to compel the release of the Epstein files, what kind of approval rating do you think that has? 90%? And what if they got together and they opposed foreign aid to Israel? What approval rating do you think that would have? 90%? What if they got together and worked on the basis of a common interest? Do you think that that Republicans or independents running under that brand, do you think that that would become more popular or less popular over time? 4 becomes 8, 8 becomes 16. It snowballs. And we need to propel someone into the White House that is just a populist. And here's where we're going to have to give. This is going to be the compromise, very simple. The left has to give up immigration. That's simple. The left is going to have to give up. Look, we can have equity and we can have equality in the country. We can have civil rights. We can have all those things. But we have to close the damn borders. We have to close it. Too many illegal immigrants. Too many legal immigrants. That has to be the compromise. The left has to give on immigration and the right has to give on the free market. If the right can come down on healthcare and on a social safety net and maybe on some subsidies for education, and if the left can come down on the anti-white open border stuff and they can agree that we have a country, that party will win 90% of the vote and rule for a century. That's the compromise. That's the populist compromise. Why is it that for the left, it's like, they don't even care about anything else. It just has to be open borders. And on the right, it's like they don't care about anything else as long as it's foreign aid to Israel and war in the Middle East and war with Russia. That's the kind of program that we need. And that's what they're terrified of. They're terrified that the left and the right are going to come together on the basis of stop supporting Israel, on the basis of close the borders, on the basis of restricting money in politics and the influence of the oligarchs. That's what they're terrified of. So this is the blueprint. We have to build on this.
Well, at least he has a vision, as delusional as it might be. And judging by what he said in his advocacy of the left and right working together, one can only conclude that either Nick Fuentes does not understand the nature of the left-right polarity, or he sits squarely on the left. But before addressing his political shortcomings on this count, let me just say that Dinesh D'Souza's earlier sharing of one parent's account of what he saw in his 11-year-old son's classroom and how he was treated amounts to nothing short of outright child abuse and psychological torture. If nothing else, it confirms why direct government funding and control of education should be totally prohibited, in favor of the approach I described earlier. And when D'Souza pondered what it was like for an 11-year-old boy to be saturated in that environment, and how institutional hostility directed at boys produces a pushback and a revolt, he was very much describing a parallel condition to that described earlier by Glenn Beck in terms of what Beck was calling the Bubba effect. And no matter how you look at it, state-funded government education is a road to ignorance and irrationality, not a road to knowledge and rationality. Meanwhile, here's Nick Fuentes' insane populist political platform. 1. Release the Epstein files. 2. Oppose foreign aid to Israel. 3. Close the borders to immigration. 4. Support both equity and equality. 5. Abandon the free market. 6. Support state health care. 7. Provide a social safety net, that is welfare. And 8. Subsidize education. Now, out of that list, there was only one policy I could get behind, and that was closing the borders to excessive immigration. On the foreign aid issue, I would advocate an end to all taxpayer-funded foreign aid across the board, not just to Israel, because state-funded foreign aid is always corrupt and never aids anyone but the corrupt. And I can't imagine anyone voting for a party that would affect his or her daily life afterwards on the basis of releasing the Epstein files. That's not even a political issue. It's a criminal matter far removed from democratic voting concerns. But the rest of Fuentes' platform is pure communism. You cannot support both equity, meaning an equality of results enforced by the state, and equality before and under the law, because that has to be violated in the provision of equity. You have to rob the Peters to pay the Pauls. And abandon the free market? The alternative is a state-controlled crony market, the very disease we have today. As to the provision of state health care, welfare, and education, well, for example, that's what Canada has now, and it's called communism, and it has turned Canada into a laughingstock around the world, even among communist countries. A free market means a market free from coercion and the initiation of force. To be opposed to a free market, otherwise known as capitalism, means being in favor of coercion and the initiation of force. And the idea of the left and right working together on the basis of a common interest is a contradiction in terms. The very reason that things are distinguished between left and right is because they are utterly incompatible. Slavery and freedom do not mix. What common interest do advocates of tyranny have with advocates of freedom? You've heard the saying, in any compromise between good and evil, only the evil side wins. In any compromise between left and right, only the left side wins. You cannot compromise between the primacy of consciousness and the primacy of existence. You cannot compromise between unreality and ignorance and reality and knowledge, or between fake and real, or tyranny and evil, or death and life, or evil and good, or between irrational and irrational. You cannot compromise between intolerance and tolerance. You cannot compromise between collectivism and individualism, or between consensus and consent, or between slavery and capitalism, or between coercion and voluntarism, or between censorship and freedom of speech, or between group rights and individual rights. So always remember, left and right, without any wings, describe a polarity of ideas, not of people. The people that Nick Fuentes is calling on to work together are not from the right and left polarities, but from the left wingers within each of the Democratic and Republican parties. All wings, by definition, are attached to some common body, whether the left wing or the right wing, or even the tail wing if you're talking about birds or planes, they're all attached to the same body. In the context of the political versions of the left wing and the right wing, the common body to which they are attached is the body politic. But no matter what wing is attached to which body, whether we're talking about the left and right wings of a plane or bird, for example, the critical observation to make about wings sharing a common body is that they are all moving in the same direction of the body to which they are attached. The left wing of a bird flying south for the winter can't just decide to fly north without bringing the other wing with it. You see the point? The same holds true for politics. If you're ever wondering why the left and right wings are always so much alike, it's because they're attached to the same body politic, which votes them into power based on what benefits each wing might provide them. Hence, you get a uniparty. And more people are interested in those benefits than they are in freedom. Essentially, both the Democratic Party and the so-called rhinos in the Republican Party are left-wingers, leaving a glaring gap on the true right. What America and many other Western nations need are political parties and candidates on the right, parties who put freedom first. So much for wings. Now for a few observations and thoughts about political polarity. Now, thanks to the fake political spectrum, whose spectrum is a spectrum of leftist ideologies, with communism and socialism on the left and fascism on the right, there has been a broad failure to recognize that what we call the political left and political right are actually polarities, meaning opposites to each other, not merely in opposition to each other for a place on the same polarity. And of course, fascism belongs on the left, while freedom, which was given no position on the political spectrum, is represented by the right polarity. There are no midpoints or centers when it comes to left and right. For the same reason that there is no middle of the road when it comes to the moral polarities of good and evil, or even the magnetic polarities of north and south, or the physical polarities of up and down. Nobody ever says that they're center down or center up. No one ever says that they're center good or center evil. Yeah, I'm on the good side of the center. I'm on the evil side of the center. I'm center evil. Jeez, it sounds so stupid. Or saying center north or center south. But saying that you're center left or right seems perfectly acceptable, even though it's just as ridiculous as all of the rest of the center positions. And given that anything called a center in this context is defined as such by the polarities against which it is described, it has no identity or position of its own in the absence of such polarities. And if that doesn't get confusing enough, notice as well that even though all of the terms here described are polarities, they are not destinations. They are directions. North is not a destination endpoint, it's a direction in which to move. Up is not a destination, but a direction. And similarly, it is with left and right, which is why we say we're moving in the right direction at the end of each broadcast, which goes something like this. You are invited to join us again next week, when we will continue our journey in the right direction, and until then, be right, stay right, do right, act right, think right. And be right back here. We'll see you then.
Fade into color, color into black and white. Under the bedclothes, everything will be alright.
Anyway, so let's talk about the election. And I was talking to my brother. My brother's all upset about the election. He's like, I go, why are you so upset? Who'd you vote for? He goes, I don't vote. How could you be upset about the election if you don't, you don't vote? Why don't you vote? He goes, Russia controls the elections, Jimmy. What? Russia controls the elections. I'm like, Danny, Russia can't even get their good vodka into Trader Joe's. Don't blame it on Russia. People voted for him. My sister's all upset. She says, I blame the election on misogyny. you know, like a typical stupid woman. And it's a risky joke. A lot of chicks in the crowd, I don't know.